Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 183 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This week's episode is sponsored by Kate on Pins and Needles, her Etsy store. She has handmade items, quilts, kitchen items, and subversive stitchery, and more. Now, if you've seen some of Kate's beautiful embroidery work, the Outlander tartan rosettes that were gifts to our friends who came to our meetup in Oregon last month, you know how beautiful her work is. And of course, her most well-known piece was that awesome apron on which she embroidered, "I'm going to an effing barbecue." In a nod, of course, to the best line of Outlander Season 1, Episode 12, written by Tony Graffia and recited by Lotta Verbeek or Galis. And just for listeners of the Outlander podcast, Kate is offering 15% off of your next order in the month of February only. Her coupon code is OutlanderPod15. That's OutlanderPod15 for 15% off your February order. Her site is etsy.com/shop/KateOnPinsAndNeedles. Kate on Pins and Needles, all lowercase, all one word. Kate on Pins and Needles, sometimes sweet, sometimes subversive, but always up for a fucking barbecue.
I can't believe you said it.
I know, I did it.
I'm so proud of you.
I know. I thought you might be. You noticed the first time I said effing, though. It's like I wanted to wait until I actually use it. And use it for the.
I was almost really sad. I was like, oh, she tried.
She tried. No, I wanted to save it, to say it once. Okay. So that was our wonderful sponsor, Kate. Now we have a little bit of an announcement. Do we want to introduce our guest so she can comment maybe on the announcements too?
I mean, that's all you, babe.
We have a friend and special guest joining us this week, and she's been on before a number of times. Most recently, I believe, I don't think you've been on for a read-along of Voyager yet, have you?
No. This is my first Voyager visit.
Oh, you're her first Voyager. Okay. So she will be, we hope she'll be back again, of course, for every book. But most recently, we would have had her on for our interview for her own book, the official Outlander Kitchen Cookbook. Oh my goodness. So with us this week is Teresa Carl Sanders, author of Outlander Kitchen. Welcome, Teresa.
Hello. Thank you so much. It's good to be back.
Yay. As I was prepping the notes for tonight's discussion, I thought, oh my gosh, I got to I think it's pretty early on in the chapter. I'm like, I know why she chose this chapter. It's pretty quick.
It's like in the third or fourth paragraph.
I know. Okay, so we're going to get to that. But first, I think we maybe have a little wee announcement or two.
We do. I think we haven't had this kind of announcement for a few weeks. We have another casting announcement. It is official. I saw his face floating around the internet, but they officially cast Mr. Willoughby. And that was Gary Young was cast in the role of Mr. Willoughby, and a Charlie Hyatt, I believe that's how you pronounce his name. If I'm wrong, I'm sorry, was cast as Captain Leonard. Now, Ginger, you said Captain Leonard was one of the captains of the Artemis?
No, actually, the press release and probably any news outlet that just got the release and went on with it, as I did originally, because I was not home and I did not have a book near me and I just went with it. You would think Stars of all people, like, I would understand if, like, Entertainment Tonight got it wrong or if, like, you know, if some other place got it wrong. That's not, you know, obsessed like we are. But Stars is, like, the place that's, like, making the show. I would expect. But whatever. Yes, they said Artemis. And actually, I did a little research. Artemis is the name of a Scottish ship in the book. But, and I'm not going to.
Oh, I know what it is without looking.
Yes,
can I say?
Yes,
I just thought of
say it.
It's the Porpoise. He's the captain of the Porpoise.
Yes. Exactly. He's the captain of the Porpoise. And apparently there's a Rains who's the captain of the Artemis. And the Artemis is a ship that the Porpoise chases at the end of the book, which I know we're getting ahead. I'm not going to say what happens. I'm not going to say who's on it. But the Artemis is in Voyager at the very end and it has a crash landing. That's all I'm going to say. But there is an Artemis. And also, I don't think it's kept up anymore. But Diana, before she had... And she had a website for quite a few years that was run by a volunteer. But Diana had a blog called Voyage of the Artemis for quite a few years before, you know, stuff went postal in a good way. I guess there's no good postal, but before it went like, you know, skyward, heavenward, yes, in a wonderful way. Okay, so those are pretty big announcements. We were wondering now, Willoughby was Gary Young is 5'8".
Oh,
which
wow.
Doesn't seem to, I mean, it's a little bit, okay, for a male, a modern Western quote unquote male. I mean, yeah, that's on the short-ish side, but it's not
small compared to Katrina.
Yes, but maybe not next to Fergus. Who knows? But I'm not going to lie. Willoughby, he is who he is. It's fine. And I'm like you said, Summer, I think compared to everyone else, it will not be distracting at all. It's just when I read the book and I hear like the way we're introduced to Willoughby is this supposed like tiny man. I get the image of this tiny man who's doing acrobatics. I don't envision. I mean, 5'8 is 5'8 is not a huge person. So it's still small ish. But yeah, I was thinking like, I don't know, 5'4. I don't know why.
I mean...
Oh, I'd put him in my head at about 5 even.
Oh, we'll see. There you go. There you go. Oh,
yeah, no, he's a tiny little... And there's lots of things about him that I don't know. We'll have to see how it goes. But he's pretty... there's a lot of stereotypes there. So about an 18th century Chinese man. So he's wearing silk pajamas. And in my head, he's about 5'1", 5'0". So we'll see.
We all had at least a somewhat similar... idea in our minds about what Willoughby would be, at least from the book.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, you can't cast people based on their height or their eye color. So I'm sure he'll be great. I'm really interested to see how the characters treat it, because it's going to be, I'm fascinated to see how it'll be. I think I assume he's going to be comic relief, but we'll see.
Yes.
You never know, he could be the dramatic key and, you know, linchpin to the entire season.
The dramatic foot fetish.
Yeah. Okay. So, Summer, bring us into the reason we're here.
Well, that would be the end of announcements. So that would mean that it's time to move on to our read-along. Virtue's Guardian, and chapter 29, Culloden's Last Victim.
Oh, I chose two good chapters.
So Ginger, start us off with 28.
Lisa T. writes, the chapter begins with Jamie, Claire, and wee Ian trying to solve the mystery of a man that followed Ian. Yes, that is a mystery. I think we'll find out. We may find out a little bit more in this chapter. So Jamie thinks that the man young Ian followed was somehow related to Sir Percival's warning of not going north. He and Claire are chatting over a meal of rolls stuffed with pigeon and truffles.
Yay.
I don't think I need to say anything. I think this is where our expert needs to come in.
That was actually the reason I chose the chapter, was because you, A, gave me a choice, and B, that was the first Outlander recipe I ever did.
Oh, yay! A little clap here. Yay! Oh, how nostalgic. That's awesome.
Now, did you do it with the pigeon?
And no, I didn't. Although squab is pigeon. So you can pretty much find squab almost anywhere. I used, at the time, what I could find, which was the closest thing was a Cornish game hen. And then instead of truffles, which would have cost $100 at least, I used porcini mushrooms. And it was a long, complicated recipe. And I learned a lot in all the years I put Outlander Kitchen together that most people don't want to spend 6 hours making pigeon rolls with truffles. So the recipe as it stands that's in the Outlander Kitchen cookbook is much easier and less unwieldy. And it's actually one of the most popular recipes. They're really good. And they're basically, I've turned them into sausage rolls.
Oh, nice.
Yes. With chicken thighs, because they're the easiest thing for everybody to find, but they work with duck or whatever. And again, dried porcini mushrooms. They're so good.
Now, would they work with the same recipe that's in the cookbook? Would it work with squab?
It would totally work with squab. It would work with squab. It would work with duck. It would work with chicken breast, if you prefer chicken breast instead of chicken thighs, which a lot of people do.
Why? Now, this may seem...
I could talk about that for 2 hours. But
so this might seem an odd question, but there's not really, well, I guess you could say there's like a meat, quote unquote, meat filler that's vegetarian. Like if you get the fake ground round kind of thing.
Yeah, you could do ground round, but it wouldn't, yeah.
It's not going to be ground the same. Ground
round is, no, it's not going to be the same. But you could do something. You have to give me a minute or two. We can keep talking, and then I'll just spontaneously say, blah!
So you mentioned the porcini mushrooms?
Yes, like dried porcinis. But, you know, like I make a pretty mean veggie burger with beans and breadcrumbs and lots of shiitakes or something like that, and that would probably work.
Oh, gosh.
You would just need to make it dense so that when you roll it and bake it, it stays together.
Now, what about some kind of, and I know it's like might be an anathema to Outlander, not to you personally, or maybe to you personally, but not to you personally, maybe, but and maybe to the cookbook. I don't know. What about something, because something like a extra firm tofu that's been frozen and thawed and something that you can, you know, soak in something so it marinates or marinated in something so it takes on that flavor. What kind of marinade might you suggest for that? And obviously, you know, probably dice up the tofu so it gets more of it covered.
Chicken stock.
Yeah, I would probably even maybe stick it in the, pulse it in the food processor.
Oh, okay.
With maybe some oats or some, again, some breadcrumbs or something to hold it together and then... Mm. You could do mushrooms.
Yes.
You could do, you want things with umami in them, which is flavor, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's like a really, you know, hey, that's, I was trying to think of another recipe I could put up online for Valentine's Day, and vegetarian version of that would be a really good idea because everybody always likes vegetarian versions, and I'm running out of Outlander recipes to do.
Well, that's a that's romantical too. The whole
it is
the rolls. It's so beautiful.
Yes, it's they're just back together, and it's a sweet little scene with young Ian is there, and it's a sweet little scene.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. Okay, so Jamie is not really worried about this one man. He says, there actually are a few different gangs that I've had trouble with, but he doesn't seem to be particularly worried about this man, the singular man. He thinks the man is likely just a rival smuggler. And he says that the way the man behaved, sniffing the brandy, all of the brandy that he bought at these different taverns and rarely tasting it, it was likely he could be a dégustateur de vin. Now, this is someone who can tell from a sniff where a wine was made and from a taste which year it was bottled. So these are the really, really, really partially genetic, partially trained, probably a combination of the two, but really, really, really wonderfully sensitive noses. Now, we have a chef here. Have you done any training with anything like that?
No, not really. I have a pretty good basic knowledge of wine, although there's so much wine now that it's sort of hard to get a handle on. So I've got some favorites that I pick at the store, but really I live with a man that won't drink wine. And so over the years we've become beer people. So I'm a pretty good beer meister, whatever the equivalent of a sommelier is in the beer world. I like a good whiskey, and I could, if you put four or five different whiskeys in front of me, I could probably come pretty close as to where they're from. But brandy and wine I'm not that sophisticated. My palate isn't that sophisticated is what I'm going to answer. I could never, ever be that. I'm Canadian and I'm not even going to attempt that French. But dégustateur de vin would not be a job for me. I don't, as you say, there's a genetic component involved and I don't have the genetic component. My dad did though. My dad was really, really good with wine, but he wasn't a very good teacher. So he never taught me. So I blame it's all my dad's fault. That's why I drink. It's my dad's and my husband's fault. How's that for a modern one?
Hey, these days you do anything goes. Apparently anything goes. So the type of man, this potential dégustateur, was valuable. And Jamie says a smart choice to put on his tail. Now we learned that I'm going to have to do it, Summer. Jared. Jared's alive.
You also sang it
Sorry.
Wrong.
I did sing it wrong, and don't worry, I'm not going to correct it, because I will give myself, I'll want to stab my ears. So Jared is alive in France, of course, and he's the source of Jamie's French brandy. Young Ian is trying to grab one of the pigeon rolls, but Jamie reminds him of his curdled wame and tells him to step off. Young Ian insists that he's hungry and he kind of pouts a little bit, and Jamie finally relents and is like, whatever, you know, do eat, just go for it. Lisa T writes, Jared is still alive. Jamie got the brandy at Jared's. She's like, sorry, I couldn't resist. I'm like, well, see, I didn't do it. It's all that part's Lisa's fault. Oh my goodness. So Jared keeps the best stuff, which he sells himself, and he sends Jamie the second quality. It's identifiable, but only by someone like one of these dégustateurs. The two taverns that buy brandy from Jamie exclusively just happen to be the two taverns that young Ian saw this man drink wine in. What worries him is that he found his way to the print shop. Jamie has worked so hard to make sure that people who know him as Jamie Roy do not know him as Alexander Malcolm. So he has all these personas. He has the printmaker. He has the print shop owner, the printer, the smuggler. And then, of course, even though he's not, he has the past of the infamous trader back from 20 years ago or so. He definitely, you know, plays that down, does not play that up at all. So he's a little bit worried that, you know, that these two things may have crossed paths and is not quite sure. Definitely it's a negative thing. He's a little bit worried, but he's also not really sure where there's a kink in the hose somewhere, if you will. Or a leak, I guess you could say, a leak. Something has, for someone to know, someone must have spilled in some way. So Jamie's only been a customer in taverns. He never has done business personally with any of the tavern owners. It's Fergus who does the business with them. And Fergus never, ever goes to the print shop. Jamie actually has it easier. He has the print shop and he can still go out to the taverns. Fergus can go to the taverns, but never to the print shop. Fergus only goes to the brothel. That's where they meet, and only in private. Now, after Claire's idea, Jamie says he'll ask Jeanne to see if a man matching the description of the one-eyed pigtailed seaman had been to the brothel lately. She thinks that it's okay. She thinks that. She thinks that there's a possibility that someone, if he had been to the brothel, that's following Fergus or maybe Jamie somehow, that maybe that was where he was able to piece together some information. Then Fergus reports that the brandy. He was able to sell the brandy off, and it was a little bit of a loss, but it was better to have it out of their hands, seeing as how things had gone down recently. And the body of the not exciseman was disguised in put into a cask of crème de menthe, and the cask is heading for the docks the next day, and then, quote, somewhere far away. So Fergus, besides Jamie, Fergus is also someone I'd want on my side if I had to get rid of a body, I guess.
I mean, I can't imagine anyone ever having that volume of that particular spirit ever.
Oh, gosh.
Like, the creme de menthe, like, it's only used in, like, one drink, right? A grasshopper? I can't think of another drink that anyone has ever created in the history of minty alcoholic beverages that requires it.
No, I mean, they probably drank it as a digestif or something as well, just on its own. But, I mean, as Madame Jean says, she calls it a refined alcohol or something. But she basically says that nobody in Edinburgh is ever going to drink it. So
it's safe.
It's safe, yeah.
So Fergus is like, okay, I'm going. And he goes to find some amusement in one of the fee. A particular fee named Sophie. And they are looking to make a pallet on the floor in Jamie's room for young Ian. And Fergus is like, why? We've got a house full of jeune fille here, and they, you know, they're not all busy. And young Ian is, you know, of age, and you guys can have your privacy. It doesn't make any sense to me. And, after all, according to Fergus, 14, quote, is certainly sufficient. And then, quote, your brothers were no older when I first brought them here, and they acquitted themselves honorably, unquote. I'm like, whoa, there's some information. Jamie is horrified, or in a nod to last week's episode title, 2 weeks ago, an episode title, Jamie is horrified. No way. Young Ian's all, yes way. Jeanne sends Fergus off to find the right girl. One, she says, oh, I know the right one. The second Mary. I don't know why that's funny, but it's kind of like, oh, Mary S or Mary D. No, the second Mary. Like, they number them off. And Jamie's struggling. Like, what just happened? What just happened in front of me? And I can imagine Claire, like, off in the corner, or like, is like basically a fly on the wall going like, I'm not part of this. Jamie is struggling with it. It's like, what am I going to say to your mom? And young Ian answers, quote, with a smile of surpassing sweetness. Well, Uncle Jamie, if I were you, I wouldn't tell her. Unquote. Oh my goodness. This... I can't wait to see these scenes, and who knows what they'll keep or what they'll not keep, but this...
Those are pretty cute. They're actually made for TV, though. That particular whole chapter you could do in like a matter of minutes, right? It would be really
absolutely
cute.
Absolutely.
And I hope they have pigeon rolls with truffles.
Oh my gosh. I hope... Okay, and I can take this... Oh, there you go. Anne S. writes, okay... Fergus has a regular fee, and he brought all of Ian's sons all the way to Edinburgh to be deflowered at the brothel. What happened with Jamie's sense of waiting for marriage? Why isn't Fergus married yet? He's 30 already. So let's just send the not yet 15-year-old nephew off for the night. Jamie really didn't try very hard to protect Ian's virtue. What do you guys think?
Maybe he didn't want him to be another... you know, 20 whatever year old virgin again.
like himself.
Like Jamie. Like, you know, no one should have to live that fate.
No, especially when your nephews are apparently getting it at 14.
Exactly.
And I think in the end, it's the fact that young Ian thinks he's killed somebody that Jamie says he may as well have a distraction, basically, rather than worry about it all night long, right?
And he did say in the first book that fighting does give men a terrible cock stand. So maybe he's just trying to help him out.
And poor wee Ian is already at that age where he's getting them randomly. So who knows? Right.
Eileen P. writes, Fergus lived at a brothel until he was 10 years old, sleeping in a cupboard under the stairs, just like Harry Potter's bedroom. Voyager came first. and Nysa Fergus to ensure no muddy male remains a virgin past 15 years old. A brothel brat, handpicking your first. Quality guaranteed. Satisfied customer. Priceless. Lisa T. writes, the irony that Ian is a virgin and Mary is experienced is an echo of Jamie and Claire on their wedding night. There is, of course, the play on the name Mary, as in the Virgin Mary. So that's funny. Jamie tells Claire that he wasn't completely honest with young Ian. He'd said that prayers and such would help, and they definitely wouldn't hurt. But that after such an event, the taking of a life, a man will find a woman, his own or another, if he must. Quote, for she can do what he cannot, and heal him. And Claire says to Jamie, what about you? Do you want a... And he replies, quote, I expect I do, but you'll be gentle with me, I.
See, that whole scene, that whole chapter's got to be in the...
Well, she doesn't...
In the series. Got to be on TV.
Well, I think he needs to be gentle with her because they were accusing her of having a rough one the night before.
Yeah. Yeah. That whole finding being naked for an hour and not having a thing and walking around without a dress was like that morning. Goodness. Joe B writes, see young Ian again. And I love that he, although young, is quickly defined as smart, intuitive, if often in the wrong place at the wrong time. His similarities to his uncle are coming out. It's through young Ian that Jamie gets to know he has been linked to both the smuggling and the print shop. Lisa T. writes, again, a wee bit reminiscent of their wedding night, and of course, a nod to the title of the chapter. Jamie has tried to protect wee Ian, but Ian has grown up quickly, has killed a man, so in a way, he has lost his virtue or innocence already. Jamie can let go with Mary because he knows she will give him comfort in a way that he can't. And wee Ian has become a man. And yep, Lisa, along the lines of, and he didn't even bleed. One of my favorite lines from Outlander. Anne S. writes, and we come back full circle when Jamie tells Claire that it is lying with a woman that will heal violence in a man's soul. A wife, or apparently any available woman, will do. Martina P. writes, the humor in the Kittlehoosie continues. Fergus, the pimp master, distributing various ladies of the night is just priceless. Young Ian gets assigned to the second Mary. That second Mary still gets me. While Jamie has doubts about young Ian being too young to engage in such activities, he clearly gets overruled by Fergus, and young Ian takes it upon himself to just step forward and disappear with second Mary. In the end, Jamie is partially convinced that the girl will help Ian get over a very troubled and overwhelming day. There's always confession the following day, and Jamie is now able to concentrate on the matter at hand, which is Claire, who offers her comfort, although he hasn't killed anyone today. However, she is asked to be gentle with him. And that's 28. What did you guys think about that chapter? As you said, it's relatively short. There's a little bit of dialogue, but mostly it's things. It's not action-packed as in, like, people are running and shooting and fighting, but a lot of things happen, and it's very fast-moving. And I agree with Teresa. It's very humorous, and it can be done so quickly.
Yeah, it's a tight little scene, I'm sure. I mean, I'm not a screenwriter. I don't know anything about it, but it seems to me it's all in that one room, right? That it would be, it's just like a play almost, so which translates to TV most of the time.
It's got a nice button.
Huh?
Like a button ending where it's like...
Oh, ding. I thought you like were playing with a button.
No. Button. Who's got the button? No, that's not what's happening. And now on to chapter 29, entitled Culloden's Last Victim.
So the next morning, Claire sees Jamie and young Ian off and starts to make her life in the 18th century as a healer. And by that, I mean, she begins to kind of dig in, to establish herself. The next morning, Claire sees Jamie and young Ian off and starts to make her life in the 18th century as a healer. And by that, I mean, she begins to establish herself. She gets a basket and begins to get medicinal supplies, like the Claire we all know and love. She returns to, I believe it's Hawes Apothecary Shop, which has survived the English occupation, the Scottish Rising, and the Stuarts' fall. She's collecting her items and sees another customer who is impatiently waiting for his order. Now, she thinks he looks somewhat familiar, but is not able to quite place him right away. She is looking for something called, I guess it's pronounced aconite. And although it has another, may have other names, she helps the young apothecary find it among the items. Apparently, his father, the elder Haw, is the one that Claire had known when she was there 20 years prior. He had passed about a year earlier and wasn't able to finish teaching his son everything about all of the ingredients, all of the herbs, all of the medicinals, everything there in the shop.
Well, that's safe. Go ahead and take over, even though you don't know anything about things.
Well, he was already taken over. He just didn't know everything. Yeah, exactly. So she realizes where she'd seen the other customer. It was in Mowbray's the day before. He asks the other man, the customer, asks if she knows what to do for fits. And Claire's like, And he describes a woman who, quote, does not but stare for days on end, not speaking, and then of a sudden she'll scream fit to wake the deed, unquote. Now she says she'd have to see the patient, and he asks if she'd be willing to come by. She agrees to go by that afternoon. And this man is the Reverend Archibald Campbell, and she finds out he is a Free Church minister. Lisa T. writes, in a reverse parallel to DIA, when Claire visits Maître Raymond, and she is the student, Claire is now the maîtress and teaches young Mr. Haw a few things about medicines. Later that day, Jamie and Claire chat outside the church while young Ian is giving his confession. Claire asks about the whole "she went to France" rubbish that Ian had said to young Ian about where she'd been the past 20 years. And he basically says that he let Sir Percival think they were newlyweds because the story he'd given to Ian about her being in France for 20 years and coming back would cause a lot more talk than if people just thought the printer took a new wife or something. What do you guys think? When you first read Voyager, and obviously if you read the books one and book two, we know the story of Claire. How did you guys first react to, first reacted to Ian when he said that? It's like, oh, she's been in France for 20 years. And number two, what did you think? Because that's something that Claire thought about a lot, right? She prepares stuff that we don't know yet, but it will come out in the next few chapters. She's really prepared. She brought more with her, let's just say, than that peanut butter and jelly sandwich. She has stuff that we don't know about yet, but we'll find out for very good purpose, very good reason. She planned the best she could because she knew that she was limited in what she could bring or take through the stones with her. So she put thought and planning into what she brought, into what she was wearing, into what she was going to do. She put planning and she put a lot of mental energy into worrying about her body and if Jamie would find her attractive after 20 years. All of this we know because it's driven home time after time. What she has not done, and we don't hear anything about, is a story that they'll be able to tell others. And of course, Jamie has had no time because it's like she pops into the shop and he's like, oh, and then he faints, right? So Jamie has had no prep. Claire's had not 20 years, but at least, you know, a month or so, maybe 2 months. She's had more prep than him. So basically, number one, what did you think about what Ian said? Number two, are you surprised that Claire didn't put any thought into a story?
No.
Wait, no, I've never really thought about it before, but now that you mention it, it leaves a wee hole, shall we say. She probably should have thought of that. Jamie's always one to think quickly on his feet. I don't know. I guess there'd be a lot of anxiety, you know, as you say, around her body and around so many other things as well. The France story is really lame, and I think I mean, it's hysterically funny. If it was, I hope that they do it with the looks on their faces that I've always imagined when Jamie's trying to tell them that story. His friend Ian would not have accepted that story at all. But as a friend and a brother, it seems to me in the story, they just accept it because they're so happy to see him happy.
Some.
Well, I was not surprised remotely because it's kind of classic Claire where she... She doesn't think everything through. Like, she has a tangential thought that is like, oh, well, I will probably need these things. But then she forgets about the most basic things, like, oh, there's a whole bunch of red coats between here and there. I can see the standing stones from here. But, you know, there's probably a bunch of red coats all around here. So maybe I should just sit still like they told me to. I just think that whole thing is classic Claire.
Well, I just think she spent so much energy, and Roger and Bree spent so much energy doing all this research, getting the coins, getting money for her. They did so much to make sure she fit in.
Because she's thinking so largely that she forgot about the minutiae.
Yeah, true. She's thinking about having, she does not need a story of where she's been the last 20 years to pop up as someone who's anonymous and get through society, or at least through Edinburgh. She does not need that because no one knows, and she doesn't need to tell anybody her business. It's not until she gets to be with people who knew her, not Jamie, but, you know, Ian, the family, anyone else that they obviously knew, which I guess now is a lot smaller party than it would have been 20 years ago. So a lot of them are dead, which is unfortunate, but probably better that way, as far as them having to lie their way through that thing. But yeah, I can see that she's thinking, okay, how do I survive? When she went back, she was planning on surviving the 18th century. She was not planning on surviving Lallybroch and family. I mean, she planned to survive them, but she wasn't thinking about, oh my gosh, what do I need to tell them? How do I make it believable? That is probably, yes, it's more important to have money, to be able to buy food, buy a horse or whatever. So I can buy that. Young Ian is taking his sweet time in the confessional, and we find out Jamie had actually already gone first. So the reason it had been so long is that Jamie had taken a long time first. We are told indirectly that Jamie is not beschnitten.
Great. Yeah. Thanks for it. That was really worth taking the time to point out.
Teresa, do you understand that?
No.
Okay.
He's rocking a turtleneck.
I like to leave it in the German. You might leave a little something for the audience not to know.
to Google later.
Oh, or that. Yeah. I mean, if they can spell it. Well, the turtleneck, they may not know, but they can. They probably definitely don't know beschnitten. But yes, the German verb schneiden or beschneiden, I guess. No, I think it's schneiden, means to cut.
Ah.
So beschnitten. Uh-huh. Beschnitten is a thing or a person, a thing who is cut. Yes.
Gotcha. Okay.
Okay.
And a turtleneck is a direct reference to foreskin.
Oh, Lord, Summer. We don't have to say that. We were trying to give all the... I think we made it clear.
It's late at night for me. Don't get me started.
Oh, Lord. Are you drinking wine, too?
No.
We should be drinking.
No, sparkling water, but that's enough for me at this point.
Ah. Okay, so we read that his rosary beads look like they've been kind of bitten or chewed, and he confirms that it was done by the bairns, all types of bairns. And speaking of bairns, of course, from the family at Lallybroch, speaking of bairns, Claire's great aunt, seven times over, and Jamie's anunkie. Always makes me laugh, anunkie. Young Ian comes out just as they start to neck. And Jamie brings his attention, young Ian's attention, to a spider Claire had seen up was on a wall or in a tree or something. And that gets him started talking about spiders spinning webs. And there are two types of silk. And the spider spins a web, but only walks on the dry tape. So the spider has two types of silk and uses both in its web making, but only walks on the dry one, because otherwise they would actually be stuck in their own web if they didn't. And the moral of this, Diana writes, to know which of your strands are sticky. And all this comes from Claire's comment about having to keep track of all your lies and how much lying you're doing, and oh, what a tangled web we weave, etc. So when Ian has come out and he borrows Jamie's rosary to do his penance, He says that Jamie will need it back because according to the priest, he was very wicked. We find out that he needs to say 5 decades of the rosary, while Jamie has to say 85.
So a decade, he has to say it. So five decades. So he has to do it 50 times and Jamie has to do it 850 times. I don't know anything about the rosary.
Okay. So a Hail Mary is said on the 10 beads within a decade. The Lord's Prayer is said on the large bead before each decade. So the large beads are Our Father or the Lord's Prayer. And then the Hail Mary is on the small beads in between. So 5 decades, he said? 5 decades would be, I guess, if you started and ended everything, it would be 5 or 6 Our Fathers and 50 Hail Marys. Yes. Yeah, that's a lot. He says, no wonder it took some time, she said, teasing. How long has it been since you've been to confession? And Jamie says, I told Father Hayes it was 6 months. And Claire asks, and was it? And he says, no. But I suppose if he was going to shrive me for thieving, assault, and profane language, he might as well shrive me for lying, too. Just get it all done. Lisa T. writes, this reminds me of Jamie taking his beatings as an example to his men before Preston fans. And I can see that. He wanted to, first of all, he probably felt he needed to, but he wanted to do it for, to show that, you know, it's a proper, for their time, for their situation, for their faith, for their religion. It was a thing that everyone had to do at a certain point, and he was going to show him that, you know, Ian had done it before. It wasn't anything new, but Jamie was like, look, you know, I've done some stuff too, because he knew he was a smuggler and all that. So I'm going to go. So I'll go first. So I can see the parallel there. Jamie has a meeting later that day with a rep from the insurance company that had insured the print shop. And he tells young Ian, I will not need you, laddie. You go with your auntie to see this mad woman. So no, nothing like go with her to see her patient, go with her to see her appointment. I'm like, Jamie just lays it down. I'm going to go over here and meet my insurance dude. You guys go over there and meet the crazy lady. You know, I'm just like, okay, Jamie, it's the way it is. Then to Claire, he says, quote, I cannot tell you, I cannot talk. Quote, I cannot tell you, can't talk.
You cannot talk.
I cannot talk either.
You cannot read your sentences.
Nope. Then to Claire, Jamie says, quote, I cannot tell how you do it. You're in the city less than 2 days, and all the afflicted folk from miles about are clutching at your hems, unquote. Oh, my goodness. Young Ian is worried about them finding a body in the ruins of the print shop, but Claire reassures him that Jamie will take care of whatever happens. He's, as you said, Teresa, Jamie's quick on his feet. He shines at that. He'll be able to take care of whatever needs to be taken care of if it comes up.
Well, now, the France thing originated with Ian.
Yeah, exactly.
So he's just filling in what Ian started.
Yeah, but we're talking about
when on his feet. I know, but I'm just talking about his whole thinking on his feet. Like, I don't think that if he'd been given more time or given the opportunity to come up with something himself, I don't know if that's the lie he would have come up with. But
oh, that's right. I forgot. Yeah, Ian. Yeah, you're right. He's been that. Maybe Ian doesn't want to know. I think they must have suspicions about Claire. I mean, she disappears, right? So
yeah.
And she's obviously odd. She's obviously odd when they first meet her. If not odd, at least a bit off. So,
yes. Claire and Ian make their way to the hotel where she is to meet the madwoman. The reverend is out, but a young woman takes her to her. It turns out the madwoman is the reverend's sister. Nellie Cowden is the name of the woman who takes her up. Miss Campbell, the sister, Miss Margaret Campbell, was staring, eyes open, looking out at nothing. Claire notes that her eyes do blink, though much less often than normal. She's been in this state, we find out, for as long as 13 days. Miss Margaret Campbell was 37, and they have no idea what... Claire has no idea what started these fits.
Here's what I want to know. They talk about her sitting for, like, what, 7, 13, however many days. Does she sleep? Or does she sit there barely blinking, catatonic but basically awake for 7 to 13 days?
She has to drink
and
eat.
She comes out of it
and she has to drink at least. Yeah.
So so crazy.
I'm sure there's a real case study that Diana's found somewhere, so I'm sure it's for real. But I mean, I do wonder, because they wouldn't have had IVs or anything, so there would have been a lot of forcing liquids down a throat and things like that. So,
oh yeah, we find out as much of the story as we're going to find out, at least in this chapter, from Nellie Cowden. So the Campbells were in Burntisland, and a woman looked after Margaret when they were, because that's where they're from. When they were still living there, there was a woman who looked after her. But when the Reverend Campbell got his, they moved to Edinburgh, to where he could do more of, I guess, more of the ministry work. And he got a, he took a position. I have the details of it. Oh, it's right here. Sorry. Now, the woman who was looking after Margaret didn't want to leave her home. That's where, because she was from Burntisland as well. And the Reverend had decided to take up the offer of the Missionary Society and to go to the West Indies. And so he moved to Edinburgh to prepare for the trip. And he took his sister with him. And because the woman who was looking after her sister didn't want to leave Burntisland, he hired someone to look after her, someone who'd be willing to travel. And Nellie was that person. So Claire is somewhat in fear of for this woman to take such a sea voyage, but Nellie says that it would be good for her to get away from the dreadful memories. And then she goes on to explain some of this horror the poor woman had undergone. Now, Margaret's father, so the Reverend's father, had been a royalist, but she'd been on the side of the Bonnie Prince. She fell for one of the soldiers, it would seem, because she left her home to meet him and to tell information she got from listening to her father and his friends. Basically, she was a spy, a would-be spy. Then came Falkirk. Desperate to know the fate of her man, she left in the middle of the night in March and went to find him. She turned back toward home. It wasn't known if she was spurned by the man or if she just had not found him. And she fell into the hands of some English soldiers. Now, they knew she was a Scot from her accent, and that was enough. This is after, yeah, these are, this is after Falkirk. So this is, it's still really bad for the Scots. She was left, they treated her very, very badly. Probably assaulted her, probably raped her, all of that. That's what we're left to guess. She was left for dead in a ditch. She was found by a family of tinkers who saved her. Now by tinkers, I get kind of a gypsy-ish feeling.
Yes, yeah.
I'm thinking little tiny fairies that live in like teapots.
I live on a little island, for people that don't know us, and every year we have a tinkerer come, and they drive an old school bus, but it's very gypsy-like. If we were still riding in caravans, they'd have a great, bright-colored caravan, and they sleep in there, and they sharpen knives.
Oh, that's fantastic.
That's a history teacher during the school year, and then in the summer, they hop in this van, and they tour all over the area, sharpening all of our knives.
And so is he living on the island, or do they bring the van onto the island?
He lives on a neighboring island, and they have a house.
Okay.
And then, but they just tour around in the summer, and they sleep, like they spend two or three nights on each island, and sharpen all their knives. And they have a cute little sign that says "The Tinkerer." So they always remind
That's
me of
adorable.
Little of little gypsies.
So do they take the ferries? Obviously, I'm guessing run between each island.
Yes.
Okay, so that's how he's able to get his truck.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. We have car ferries running between mainland and then between the islands as well.
By ferry, you mean like a boat as opposed to Tinkerbell?
Yes, Summer. Okay.
Just checking, because I was getting really enamored of her island. Having ferries that would take you from the mainland to the island.
Those are pretty strong ferries.
Come on.
Well, then actually it wouldn't be, because I mean, I don't know how much of it, part of it has to be since knives are typically like galvanized steel, right? Knives are a mixture of elements.
Yes.
There has to be iron in there somehow. So I'm guessing that fairies wouldn't be around knives.
They may have, they're tinkers. They may come up with gloves that they could wear to protect their skin. You don't know.
I'm thinking it's not just
touching for me.
It's not just touching. Touching absolutely is out. But no, it's being around it. It's like kryptonite. It just weakens them. They don't have to touch it. I studied this. I'm just kidding. I didn't. Okay, so
we keep on this.
It's okay. So she was found by a family of tinkers who saved her. Now, she went with them and lived with them, but she didn't speak. She traveled with the Tinkers until one day she was with them. So her brother found her with the Tinkers. She was out there while they were busking, and she was out basically not panhandling on her own, but with a little collection plate or so, and collecting money for the Tinkers. And yeah, and her brother found her. Now, she recognized him, and this shock gave her back her voice, but not her mind. He took her in, of course, but she always thought she was in the past. Her brother resigned his commission with the army and took care of his sister. He couldn't marry, though, because of her, and because who'd want to take that, both of them, on? And he turned to God and became a minister, and he'd found a decent amount of success in the ministry. Claire said there wasn't much she could do, but she would give Nellie some prescriptions or receipts that at least if they didn't help her, they wouldn't hurt her. She tells her, having noticed the pale gums of Margaret, that once they reach the Indies, they need to eat. She must eat a lot of fruit, and said actually they all should. And of course, Nellie's like, really? People are just not into fruit in those days. It just wasn't a...
It was hard to come by.
Well, it wasn't... Yeah, they weren't necessarily like dropping off of trees. Ha, ha, ha. It wasn't necessarily on every corner. But yeah, it was... And maybe that's why she said in the Indies. Because in the Indies, it would be a lot easier to find because of the climate. But do you know... What do you know about that?
They're just really skeptical of vegetables back then. The ones that... Like, Highlanders would be quite different because they would be growing vegetables, and most of them actually lived on kale. But the city dwellers, it's a completely different situation. And the food in Edinburgh and Glasgow in particular at that time is so bad, and everybody's sick.
Oh.
And of they have nutritional deficiencies, all of them.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, there it may have been a problem of transportation, and there's just not a lot of vegetables getting into, much like urban, the urban centers of this in America and in Canada as well, where sometimes there's only a 7-Eleven to shop in a downtown core, right? And I think maybe they had problems getting vegetables into the middle of the cities. But people are really skeptical of them the whole time. Like, I mean, every time Claire tries in all the books to give somebody some sort of turnip broth or something, they all look at her like she's crazy. So, and if you've ever had turnip broth, you don't really want to drink it anyway. But
you said a key phrase. It's in all the books. Another way to say it is in, without giving away too many spoilers, on any continent. Basically, it was a sign. I can't say a sign of the times because who knows? In Italy and in southern Spain, you're probably talking something different, right? Because the royal families and people of those in those eras, in those times, not only was their climate completely different, and so they could grow these things, and they had, you know, more influence, more of the Arab influence, so they had that. But if some people were to go maybe look at the colonies, the American colonies, I don't think they were so hot to trot for these vegetables or at least these fruits either, were they?
No. Pork certainly ruled the day in North Carolina. That's pretty much, they ate pork. And then it was actually the slaves coming from Africa that introduced a lot of more vegetable matter into the diets of their owners. And the white people on the plantations. So collard greens, all that kind of stuff. That's where traditional Southern cooking starts, is in those years. And it's a lot of it is based on recipes and techniques that slaves would have brought them with them from Africa.
But think of the time, though, before anyone knew, or for the people who don't know, I mean, you could look at six berries that look exactly the same, and four out of them might be edible, and two of them might kill you.
Kill you.
So if you don't know enough,
yeah, totally,
about it, it's easier to just not.
No, Kira.
And just be like, I'm going to pass on that because that has a 2 in 6 chance of killing me.
At this moment, Claire's about to leave and she pulls open the door to see young Ian. And he was just about ready to say, you know, it's time to go. He says that he was just coming for her and says, Uncle Jamie said, but at the mention of the name Jamie, Margaret says, Jamie, and starts to scream.
It's kind of like if you ever go to any of the Outlander events now.
Oh. Very good. Very good. Ann S. writes, why does Margaret start screaming when she hears Jamie's name? Eileen P. writes, oh no. Margaret Campbell woke from her trance screaming after hearing Ian say Jamie's name. That can't be good. Lisa T. writes, next, Claire and Ian go to meet Claire's patient, who is Culloden's last victim, Margaret Campbell. She has gone mad as a result of a severe assault by the British after Culloden. In the course of her examination, Claire learns that her brother, the Reverend, is taking her to the Indies. So, now that you said, Teresa, that Diana probably found a case study similar, so she was basing it off of a factual, at least factual scientific case, and then she probably made up, you know, the maybe the time, maybe not, but made up the name and the circumstances. I'm now wondering, because was it, and maybe I'm totally spacing on something that we do find out in the next few chapters, I don't even know. I understand because of the person that she was pining for, or now, you know, gone cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs for, because her mind broke after what happened to her. I take it back. She's cuckoo because of what the British did, not because she was sad. But the person that she loved or that she was trying to find was gone after Culloden, but she didn't know that at the time because she didn't leave after Culloden. She left her Falkirk. It was still March. But why do you think Diana needed to link, again, unless there's something major that I'm totally spacing on, why did Diana need to link her to Culloden in some way, or someone she loved to Culloden? Obviously, it's heartening, it's sad, it links it to readers. Readers have a lot of feeling for her, number one, because of her condition and what happened, but also because because of what Diana wrote, she is Culloden's last victim, or at least a victim of Culloden. Why do you think she did that?
It's all part of tying all the characters together, because it comes back later.
Okay, that's what I'm asking, so I'm forgetting something.
And then to add to that, I just think that she's constantly going back to Culloden, right? Because that's where everything changes for the Scots. And so repetition is good, but also it allows her to tell another part of Culloden without dealing with what happened to Jamie. Because we draw that out for, I mean, many more books. I mean, we still don't even really know. So I think it's just another way to revisit Culloden and bring up that emotional tie that you were talking about earlier. And then it brings all the characters together. It does a lot of things. A seemingly innocuous little mention of Mary, sick Mary, and her beau.
Very good. I look forward to not only exploring more in this book, but yeah, to finally, speaking of Culloden and Jamie, dude, I have a feeling that's along with the ghost. We're not going to hear that until the last book.
No. Yeah. Well, yeah. Although apparently they've told us, haven't they? Hasn't Stars teased us? Or I read somewhere that...
Oh, they filmed Culloden.
Yes. And that we actually find out more in this season coming up on TV than we already know in the books. I think that's what I read somewhere.
I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that. I understand it's visual and they have to show. Obviously, you can't, like, in a visual medium, you have to show. I understand that, but it's one thing to have like more Frank than in the book, because it's not something that, you know, you're not changing the characters, right? Not that they're doing that either, but it's one thing to show stuff that may or may not have happened off screen or off page because you don't know.
Right.
It could have happened, but to show and just because it's being shown doesn't mean it didn't happen in the book. So that's, I guess, not even a good argument, but I don't know. I don't know. I have, it's kind of hard for me to wrap. And I know, not divorce, but separate the adaptation from the books. I do that. But it's, you said, Teresa, very explicitly, and you're right, that only once a book, or maybe once every other book from here on out, we only get hints of what happened. We still don't know what happened in the last moments and why BJR was on top of Jamie. We don't know who stabbed him. We don't know these things. So not that I don't want to know. Of course I want to know. But I was content to let it unfold as Diana would. I think, I don't know. It just makes me kind of sad. If we find out, hopefully they don't do everything. Hopefully there's just the battle. Like, you can show a lot of a battle, at least the beginning. And then, like, even at the very end, you can show, like, the scarred battlefield. You can do a lot without showing what she is keeping from us.
You totally can. You totally can. Yeah.
And that's what I'm going to hope for.
They could even choose to lead us astray. They could show us images that aren't even necessarily what happens, but it sort of whets the appetite for more. Who knows? I mean, I think it's been great so far.
No, that's
so
true.
And like you have to divorce yourself. But there is, yes, when, I don't know, for Game of Thrones too, there's a little book hangover when you're a book fan and then you see it change on the screen and you're like, oh, but then after about 5 minutes, I'm usually like, yeah, okay, that works.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So they leave and return to the brothel to Jamie and Fergus, where they were talking about Sir Percival. They didn't trust him, but didn't quite know why he would warn them about an ambush if he were actually against them. They conclude that there's likely going to be an ambush by the excisemen around Mullins Cove, and they are chatting about the location of the supposed raid. They agree on a location about where they should do their thing. So Fergus goes to spread the word about this change because Jamie, as just like he doesn't do the business in the taverns, is not doing business with a lot of people because he tries to keep those lives and those names separate. Young Ian, of course, wants to be part of the adventure. Claire asks about the danger of the upcoming raid, and Jamie fills her in. Sir Percival was warning him that the location of the rendezvous in 2 days' time, that might be, that it was compromised. It's very technical and complicated, the arrangement of all of these rendezvous, and I'll leave it to Jamie. There are safety valves planned into the arrangement, and by that, I wanted to sum it up briefly, because Jamie goes on about letters from Jared and three different places and things aren't opened and people don't know and Fergus only knows like one and there's like a back. I mean, it's really complicated. They go above and beyond making sure to protect themselves and to have a backup plan. So that's good. But I can talk about time travel. That fascinates me. I get a headache, but it fascinates me and I can go on for hours. This, I can't do it. It's a lot of stuff, put it that way.
I'm sorry. I just listened to the 181 and you talked in such a circular fashion about dying, but not being able to die before you were born, or I don't know, but it went, but this you can't grasp?
Yeah, exactly. No, okay. I grasp it. I grasp it in that it's multi-layered and it's well thought out and a lot of time and but basically it was like so much going on and like I wasn't quite, I get that there were multiple places, but that not everyone, like I don't even think Jamie knew the places, but apparently Jared did, but three different things were sent to different, I mean, I can't even talk about it. So I don't know. It was really complicated and it's good that it was because it helps protect them. That's all I'll say. And it's set. They decide they'll go to Arbroath, but young Ian will stay with Claire at the inn on the road above until they're done with whatever they need to do. And then they've got to get young Ian home to Lallybroch, and they can try and mend things with his parents. Ian had left that morning without leaving a message for Jamie. So Ian's in a tiff. I understand, but why? But still, he's in a tiff. So Jamie's feeling really bad, and he knows he needs to get things done as quickly and safely as he can, but then get out of Dodge. Now, as they're discussing this, young Ian says, "But Uncle, what about?" And Jamie snaps, "Be still. That will be all from you, laddie. Not another word, aye?" So young Ian just eats another oat cake and remains silent. Now, what we don't see, which means there probably isn't one, is a reaction from Claire to all this. Diana's very good about giving, about describing, at least, of course, when she wants you to, of course. Diana's very good about telling you if so-and-so had a facial reaction to something. She does it with when Claire and Frank have their last conversation the night he dies in the bed. She describes how Frank's face is shocked or like really surprised when she brings up his mistresses, the adultery. And other times we are told about someone. Someone flinches or has a physical reaction to something, or like their face, a facial twitch, or like they smile or their eyes grow large. Dana's very good about giving us that. I'm very surprised in this little back and forth when Jamie like went off the handle that we don't have any reaction from Claire.
No, that's true. Because that's, isn't that the second or third time he's cut people off when they're about to start talking about Lallybroch?
I think so.
In front of Claire, right? Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, I didn't think about it until... I didn't even think about... Well, no, I guess I thought about it when I was reading earlier, but I didn't make a note, but I just thought about it again, so I thought I'd bring it up because... Summer, what do you think?
I don't.
You don't think that means anything? You don't think it's interesting that we don't have any of Claire's reaction here? It's like she's oblivious.
I wasn't listening.
Okay, when they're talking about taking Ian to Lallybroch, and then Ian says, but uncle, what about, and Jamie cuts him off and snaps, be still. That'll be all from you, laddie, not another word, aye? He doesn't let him talk about whatever, finish his sentence, basically.
Right. Well, we know what he was going to say.
Of course, but that's what I'm saying. We don't have a reaction. We have Ian talking, Jamie cutting him off. So we know Jamie's reaction. He's like, you shut your mouth. You stop it. Nothing. You will not say anything else. Claire is just, I guess, eating oatcakes. We don't have her reaction to anything. Like, Jamie, what the hell's wrong with you? What are you doing? What's up?
Well, she's also pretty blasé about everything else he's gotten into while she's been gone. But it's not the first time he's quieted down somebody else who started talking about something.
Well, that's, yes, and that's, I think, is what Teresa was saying, is it's not the first time that this has happened about something, about conversation about Lallybroch.
Well, not even just about Lallybroch, though. Like,
no, but about Lallybroch or things that he's, that the conversation has been stopped in some fashion. Martina P. writes, the story about Margaret Campbell is very mysterious, especially when she suddenly screamed Jamie's name. I immediately suspected that she might have met Jamie during Culloden and had fallen in love with him. I was relieved to learn from Jamie that she was his friend's sweetheart. Claire tells Jamie about her visit to the Mad Woman. Jamie thinks he actually might know of this Margaret Campbell. It was Ewan Cameron's sweetheart. He tells Claire that Ewan had been shot 2 days after Culloden. Martina P. writes, the story about Margaret Campbell is very mysterious, especially when she suddenly screamed Jamie's name. I immediately suspected that she might have met Jamie during Culloden and had fallen in love with him. I was relieved to learn from Jamie that she was his friend's sweetheart. I do wonder why the good Reverend Campbell was absent during Claire's visit when he requested the appointment. Did that make you guys think twice or no?
Not the first time I read it, no.
Okay, okay. So they set off to do the prep for their rendezvous, as well as to leave Edinburgh. Young Ian is to go back to customers who hadn't gotten their orders, and Jamie gives him money, and he's supposed to reimburse them or pay them back. Jamie says it could take him about 2 months to be up and running in a new place with a new print shop. And so by these words, we know that Jamie, and thus Claire, because she will not leave him, she's planning on being with him now and forever, that their plans are to come back to Edinburgh, ultimately. Now, Claire's job is to get, he asks her, is to get a proper gown, because Daphne needs her dress back, and she can't go back to Lallybroch naked. Lisa T. writes, and I agree with her wholeheartedly, I love Jamie's practicality. Yes, you need a dress because we can't be naked, and you can't have that one, so let's go. So what did you guys think was the highlight or the most important part of, or something surprising from either one or both chapters?
The most important thing? I think just Jamie's revelation that somebody knows who he is, and somebody, and that he's in a serious amount of danger because somebody has connected Jamie Roy with James Fraser. And of course, Pigeon Rolls and Truffles. They're very, very important.
Yes. So I agree. The fact that someone, Jamie's a little worried or a lot worried, but even when Jamie's a lot worried, he's a very cool cat. He doesn't, like, it takes something like Culloden looming on the horizon to send his wife away. I mean, obviously that's major, but he doesn't freak out until something like Culloden. I mean, Jamie's a very cool cat. So you're not going to get a Jamie, you know, who's like, oh my God, oh my God. It's just not going to happen. So yeah, he holds his stuff together pretty well. But yeah, that's true about the scary that someone might know two of his names, two of his identities, as well as the pigeons. The pigeons are pretty great. The pigeon stuffed rolls are pretty great. The I love 28, just the humor of it. It's so much of what Diana does. I mean, there may be chapters with very little to no humor, but I don't think so. She infuses so much with humor, and it lightens up darker moods and lightens up sad scenes. And that's what I think. And it's so hard. I think she says it's hard. They say it's hard to write dialogue. I think it's hard to write humor well. And I think I think she does an amazing job with that.
Yeah, I agree. She does a really, really good job with it. And it is hard to convey. I mean, we use a lot of emojis now because we can't convey emotion without them. And she does it. She really describes the whole spectrum of emotion really beautifully. But you're right, humor. She always gets Jamie's humor at the right places when things are dark, or Claire's humor when things are dark and light. Just like you said, it lightens the load and makes reading sometimes possible, because we go into dark places, and if you don't spike it with humor, then it gets too dark, and a lot of people wouldn't be able to read that, or wouldn't. I don't even know if you would want to read it, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely.
Well, I mean, look back to the whole Wentworth section. There's of the first book. I mean, she gets real, real dark in there. That was,
yes.
I mean, to have written, the same person who wrote that wrote this last chapter. Let's think about that.
That's true.
That was chapter 29. Join us next time when we discuss chapter 30 entitled Rendezvous and chapter 31 entitled Smuggler's Moon, which will bring us to the end of part 6.
Well, thank you to our guest, Teresa Carl Sanders from Outlander Kitchen. Thank you, Teresa.
It was my pleasure to join you. It was a lot of fun again. Thank you for having me.
Of course. And keep an eye out, or I almost said keep a tongue out. That sounds really bad. I meant like in the vein of flavors and tastes.
Keep your tongue out of the vein.
Summer. Keep an eye, I guess an eyeball out because it's reading, but keep an eye out on the rest of the chapters of the book and see if there's anything else. Wait, were we going to have you back for something like turtle soup?
Oh, we could do turtle soup.
Is that good?
I would love to come back and do turtle soup with you.
You're welcome back anytime. Just let us know which chapters interest you the most. And if turtle soup or more interests you, just let us know. But yes, it's an open door invitation. You're always welcome here.
Oh, thank you, ladies. That's very nice. I always have a good time when I'm with you.
And so do we. So thank you to your listeners so much. Well, that sounded like I was going to say listener twice. So thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.